Hello and welcome to the Scripts and Scribes Social, our casual chat show where we converse with some of our favorite industry folks. Today we're chatting with our good buddy and all-around swell guy, Daniel Seco. He's a literary manager who represents writers and directors for film and television. He had a stint at Netflix working in original programming and has worked at agencies like CAA and Resolution and management firm writ large before teaming up with Gavin Dorman at Schemers Entertainment in 2018. Welcome back, Dan. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
How are you doing in the age of coronavirus? How are things in self-isolation, quarantine? How are things going for you?
I'm hanging in there. I think that's maybe the most appropriate way to phrase it. I think I hit my 2 months of being inside about 2 days ago. Definitely was on the earlier side of making that decision. Just trying to take things a day at a time. Maybe I'm doing a little bit less each day than I had earlier on. I think it's about self-care and setting goals for the day, but not getting carried away in terms of, oh my gosh, I only got to X amount of things today. I still think I'm working 7 days a week, but I think like I've put in limitations for myself so that I don't burn out too quickly.
Right. How are your clients handling it?
I think it's a mixed bag. Some clients are more focused on just taking care of themselves, taking care of their family. You know, for the ones that have other responsibilities in terms of day jobs and things like that, adjusting to working from home. There's others that are doing great, that are really just taking the time to polish scripts, come up with new ideas, work on drafts, doing rewrites. So I think for me, it's everyone is going to approach the current situation a little bit differently. I just want to be supportive for them, however that looks. There's no expectation of, oh, what do you mean you didn't write a script during the pandemic? If writing helps them get through it, that's great. If writing is not a priority right now, I just keep checking in on them to see how they're doing and if there's anything I can do to help them beyond the scope of writing or anything Hollywood related. I'm happy to, you know, just talk with them and just, you know, connect with them on a human level.
Right. In terms of the business, what's the development landscape looking like these days? Is there more development because people, especially filmmakers and a lot of people who work in production, things like that, have less to do because there's no obviously physical production going on? Or is it slowed down because nothing's being produced or sort of a backlog of stuff?
I think the bar is a little bit higher in terms of what people are looking for. For me, we are working on a few different projects that hopefully, if they reach their potential, I'm going to start to take them out maybe next month. But I think like if it had been, oh, I had a script ready in March or April, I would have been hesitant. I mean, I know some other managers have taken projects out and have had a little bit of success. But I think every company is a little bit different. I've been checking in with people. Some folks want to do meetings that we were supposed to have in person, over Zoom or over Skype. It's not my favorite thing to do, but I have transitioned into doing that more with clients. We've actually signed, I believe, 3 clients since this all started.
Wow.
And clients that fit like into the top 25% of our client list, which is really exciting. There's a couple other folks that we have our eyes on that would seem like good fits. So I think in that sense, we're still trying to move forward with signing new talent. We found a couple projects that Gavin, my producing partner, is going to take on. I think we're about to attach a director to a client's project, actually 2 different directors on 2 different projects. So that's kind of exciting. I think it's more this. We're trying to figure out how we can navigate things in-house, productions we could put together, things from our own clients that we can, you know, add elements to get more attractive so that when it comes time to bring it to financiers, there's just a little bit more urgency. So I think we're slow playing projects a little bit more now, really making a strong case as to why something needs to move forward and how it fits into the shifting landscape.
You just mentioned that you guys have signed three new clients in the past couple of months during the pandemic. So I was going to ask you, is this a good time to, for those emerging writers out there who don't have representation, to seek representation? But clearly, in your case, it seems to be the case.
Well, I mean, the people that we signed are a little bit more established. Mm-hmm. One was a writing team, and they had left their manager and wanted to find new representation. And I think it was one of my clients that made that connection and introduced me to them. Another person has agency representation, someone we've been chasing maybe for almost 2 years now, but finally just pulled the trigger, and it seems to be a good fit. So I'd say this, you know, I talked about the bar being higher for clients' projects. I think the bar is a little bit higher in terms of what we're looking for in terms of clients. It doesn't mean we're only going to sign people that have credits or an agent or have had representation before, but I'm not looking to add people that become a bottom 25% client. I think that's an even more uphill battle. It's never easy to break up and coming writers. I think I'm hesitant to take someone on that fits in that category, just because I don't know if there's as many opportunities for them right now. I'd say for writers that are listening to this that haven't had reps before, that are looking to secure representation from a manager, take the time to beef up your samples, get your stuff in the best shape possible. You know, if you were sending stuff out in the fall, winter that was getting rejected, I don't think it's going to move the needle now. I think you got to come out with something a little bit stronger. I just think the expectations are that much higher.
Right. Well, this great opportunity to work on their log lines. We're doing the Logline Madness competition, which you've been generous with your time to be one of our judges. So thanks for that. That's awesome. And I wanted to maybe talk a little bit about log lines today, because obviously they're crucially important. I think writers underestimate the value of a great log line, thinking, oh, it's just a couple sentences. It's a breeze. But because it's so short and it's really your calling card of your project, and in some ways in a query for you, period, it's vital that it's really, really well done. Do you have any advice on or tips to for log lines? Like, what are things that writers need to know about their log line?
Sure. I would say for writers that are seeking representation, log lines at that point in your career are never going to be more important than right now. In the sense that if I'm going on to, say, the blacklist, for example, I'm looking at log lines. I don't care about what rating the script got. I just want to get a sense of, what is this? Is this a film or is this a story? Is this something that can attract an audience? Is this something that feels derivative? Does this add something new to the conversation within the genre? Is it clean? Did they put thought into it? There's so many ways a log line can go wrong. I would say most log lines are poor. It becomes a little less of a priority, say, if you're like already an established writer and people are coming to you, but still, even for me with clients that have spec scripts and maybe it's their first or second thing that's gone out onto the town, you know, we really put in the time and the effort, Gavin and myself, we go back and forth for hours. I would say for us to come up with one good log line, we probably go through like 50 bad ones. And it's something we put on ourselves. We generally write it for our clients. For some reason, it feels like we can do a better job than they can. I don't know. It's just this habit that we've fallen into, but we really just push each other to come up with the best log lines possible. I'd say, you know, some people say you can have a log line that's two sentences. I try to stick with a longer one sentence log line. Mm-hmm. I want to get a sense of the protagonist, the stakes, the world. And, you know, where's the urgency? Why should I give a shit? You know, and does this fit somewhere? Does this actually, is this a thing? You know, you could have a well-written log line, but if it's just immediately, this is not a film, this is not a project, that's something I consider beyond just the language itself.
I want to run a few log lines by you, log lines that were submitted to the competition, and they were in, I believe, in different genres than you. You judged action, adventure, sci-fi, fantasy the first round, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's... I think so. So these are some different, from different genres, from different categories. So I don't think you've heard any of them yet. So I want to run a few of them by you and see, get your feedback and maybe some advice on how they can improve it.
Sure. Sounds great.
The first one is a TV comedy. It's called Rehab Beach. And it's, the logline goes, after a drug-related accident, a Hollywood actress is sentenced to 6 months in rehab, but when she gets to her Malibu Beach Rehabilitation Center, she finds out the party is just starting. Initial thoughts?
It's tough because I immediately know that something like that is not for me. So I don't know how to separate that in the sense of, is that technically well written? Yeah, it's okay. I think I have a sense of what it is. Does it feel overly familiar? Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's introducing so much new territory that there's absolutely urgency there. You know, could it be a show? Potentially. I think greater specificity would help that. Like, it's clean, it's to the point, but almost maybe a deeper dive to give stronger details would maybe help differentiate this project from others that kind of touch on the same space.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a TV comedy, do you get humor in that log line? Like, would you have known it was a comedy based on the log line?
I mean, I think it could have comedic sensibilities, but there's nothing about that log line that makes me chuckle. I suppose the writer's aiming for this idea of like a fish out of water situation, but celebrities do go to rehab. So I don't know what exactly makes it funny, but I do recognize that the world could present comedic moments.
Mm-hmm. And when it says that, at the end of the logline, I'll read it again. After a drug-related accident, a Hollywood actress is sentenced to 6 months in rehab, but when she gets to her Malibu Beach Rehabilitation Center, she finds out the party is just starting. When it says she finds out the party is just starting and that's the end of the logline, does that give you enough? Do you want more, or is that enough?
I think there's probably just a little bit too much ambiguity there.
Mm-hmm.
It could be received a million different ways. I don't necessarily know if I had to bet what it would look like on the screen in terms of that particular twist. I'm assuming that maybe once she gets into rehab, there's even more drugs and partying and mayhem and chaos and whatnot, but that's just speculation. So perhaps defining it a little bit more while still leaving some things up for interpretation. There's a balance to be struck. I think diving a little bit deeper would be helpful.
Right. To me, it could almost be, I don't want to say a dramedy, but because it's relating to a drug-related accident, sentenced to rehab, and finds out the party is starting, to me, the comedy feels almost a little bit ambiguous in that. Like, there's nothing about that. Like, if you removed comedy, I wouldn't necessarily know what genre it was, per se. That's just me, but...
It's totally fair. And to me, like, just going beyond, does that feel like a show or does that feel like a writing sample? To me, that feels like a writing sample. I just don't know why someone would say, hey, that stands out so much more than similarly themed projects. I think for something like that to move forward, it's really dependent upon attachments, be it talent, production company, you know, big time producer. There's nothing that really elevates it. It feels like too familiar territory.
Right. And the fact that it says the Hollywood actress is sentenced to 6 months in rehab, but when she gets to her Malibu Beach Rehabilitation Center, does that bother you that it's in the verbiage there?
In the sense that it's like...
Sort of repetitive. Rehab and rehab center.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, for me, would I pass off of this log line? I would.
Okay. And what about the title, Rehab Beach?
It sounds like a reality, like,
oh,
sex
gotcha.
Show,
yeah, yeah.
Like, with, like, good-looking people on a beach somewhere.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, cool. Here's the next one.
You're like, actually, that just got set up at Netflix.
That's awesome. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I mean, I think that that's actually a pretty accurate description. The second one is called Oh Pariah. It's a TV limited series drama, and the log line is 1870s Kansas. A former slave becomes the sole guardian of a cult leader's white daughter and must protect her from vengeful hordes, convinced that only the child's death can put an end to the expanding sect. I'll do it one more time.
Sure.
1870s Kansas, a former slave becomes a sole guardian of a cult leader's white daughter and must protect her from vengeful hordes, convinced that only the child's death can put an end to the expanding sect.
I mean, let me just start by saying this. If you're an unrepped writer, don't write a limited series unless you have significant IP.
Okay.
Because it's just such an uphill battle and so wholly and completely dependent on, okay, who's your A-list director that's going to direct every episode? Who's your A-list talent? Like, look at any limited series that's had any semblance of success. It's definitely going to be based on a book or an article, and you're definitely going to have at least one A-list actor or actress. So, like, that immediately takes me out. If we're just looking at this in a vacuum, is this a solid log line? Yeah, it seems different. It seems interesting. I mean, there are inherent limitations that it's period. It's going to be more expensive. It's probably a niche audience. It's probably got to be a prestige feel. It's likely premium cable or streaming. So it's already in an absolutely completely narrow box, with the contingency of it only moves forward with certain elements getting on board. So, like, I can't not look at that component. You know, I have to consider that beyond just the, oh, is this well written? So, like, I have a hard time turning that off. In terms of the actual language, I think it's interesting. I mean, I love, like, a slightly deeper dive into character, but I get a sense of the world. I get a sense of the stakes. I think it is well written. I just know immediately it's not something that I'd want to get invested in because of the limitations beyond the scope of what it's about.
Right. Now, vengeful hordes, when it says that this former slave must protect her from vengeful hordes, convinced that only the child's death can put an end to the sect. Vengeful hordes, do you want to know more about what those are, or is that enough? Like, will it become too wordy if you start figuring out what those people are? Like, are you curious? Like, does that leave you sort of wanting more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, if we compare it to the last log line, mm-hmm. there's a balance here in terms of what's on the page versus do we need to ask more questions if we're intrigued by it. I think you could capture someone's attention with what you have within this log line, but I do think that there are further questions that would be asked. But I think that's something that would maybe be resolved by actually reading the script.
Sure. Now, it's cult leaders. They're talking about a cult leader. Would more description of that, like an end of the world cult, or I don't know what other kind of cults there are. I haven't done enough research on that. But would that increase your interest in it, or it's cult leaders enough and you know kind of what it's about? Enough so that you can make your decision based just on that.
I think it narrows it down enough. I think mm-hmm. for me, like, it either piques my interest or it doesn't. You know, there's nothing that, like, that particular writer could add to that log line. It's a very specific project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea of, like, when you take out a script, you obviously aren't trying to have 100 people buy it. I mean, you'd want, like, 10 people raising their hand and showing interest. But at the end of the day, it's only one person that takes it on. I think a project like this, because of the very narrow boxes that it's kind of put into, it's either the right fit or it's not. It's very clear. It's not like, oh, well, if I only had, you know, dove in a little bit deeper into the specificity related to the cult, then maybe I would have gotten more people. I don't think so. I think, like, there's enough there that says, hey, this is what it is. I know it's not for everyone, but I think I've given enough that if this fits like something you would do, you would be attracted to it.
Right. Well, and you would mention something like this, a limited series specifically, needing a name actor. Now, with a description like a former slave, it's so vague, you don't know if it's male or female or age range. So does that make it more difficult because you can't visualize it? You just kind of have to kind of guesstimate? Or is it more appealing because you could slot anyone into it in theory until you read it, I guess?
I think there are certain projects where the protagonist being male or female makes a significant difference. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that the character has a slave background is enough of like, oh, that's interesting. There could be something there. I don't think my mind ever really got consumed by the idea of, oh, are they male or female? I think that might just almost be like too narrow in terms of focus. It's rather just like, we have enough of a definition for this character. Further details could be picked up as I actually dive into the script.
Right. Right. I think for me, the fact that they mentioned the white daughter, like I can overlook the fact, like I have no idea if it's the girl is 6 or 16, or I mean, I'm assuming she's younger, but she could be an infant for all I know. I don't know. And that's okay. But for me, at least, like when you're talking about your lead, I at least kind of want to know the gender, the age range. I mean, maybe just that's just me in my head. It doesn't solidify as a visual idea until I kind of know what your protagonist, at least, again, their gender, maybe, and their age, or, you know, the range. But I mean, I don't know. Okay.
No, that's totally fair. I mean, I kind of view it sometimes as being very malleable.
Yeah.
In the first place, I think we've had like two projects where the leads switch gender this past year, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. One script in particular, we took it from being a male protagonist to female, and it's just night and day, completely different in a great way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe because of my own personal experience, I don't view it as like, oh, we're so locked into this. You know, I think if the writer of this log line was able to like weave that into, you know, the sentence to drive greater clarity, then that's fine. I just wouldn't want it to feel bogged down by it.
Right. And lastly, in terms of this log line in particular, then we'll move on to the next one. When they talk about the put an end to the expanding sect, I'm assuming they use the expanding sect to sort of increase the threat of this log, you know, for the protagonist and the girl. But it seems it could be wordy. Do you think it's necessary? Does it help anything? Does it?
I think I picked it up in terms of how that's supposed to be received.
Yeah.
It could be softened a little bit. It could be, you know, dumbed down just so that there's 99% clarity.
Sure.
You know, you don't want someone to read a log line and be somewhat intrigued and then have to like, okay, sect. Oh, it's a group and it's tied to like having different religious beliefs or whatever. You know, like a cult within a cult or a part of a church or something like that. I would be curious to see what was left on the, you know, cutting room floor, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
You know, what other versions of this log line could have been used, because maybe there's just a simpler version of it that gives immediate clarity and just lands with every reader. And I think that's something to definitely be mindful of.
Right. Great. Okay. The next one, it's called Lunar Caustic, and it's a feature drama, or drama feature, I should say. And the log line is, when she discovers a way to reach the god she blames for a family tragedy, a Victorian alchemist puts an unwilling test subject through a painful metamorphosis at a masquerade ball. I'll read it one more time.
Sure.
When she discovers a way to reach the god she blames for a family tragedy, a Victorian alchemist puts an unwilling test subject through a painful metamorphosis at a masquerade ball. Initial thoughts?
You know, I generally hold back. I don't want to like hurt people's feelings. This one just seems like there's so much going on I have no idea where this fits within a particular landscape, which boxes, like I have no idea about comps. It's a tough one for me. I don't necessarily get how this will be cinematic, what your audience would be, you know, where does this land? What is this? That's the biggest issue. I also think structurally, the way the beginning of the logline is set up, I don't know. I don't love that.
Right.
It just doesn't flow for me.
I do think that for me, structurally, it seems off. Like it seems when you start it, when she discovers a way to reach the god she blames for, I'm already trying to figure out, well, who is she? Whereas if you start it with a Victorian alchemist, at least I know who you're talking about, not halfway through your log line. So I do think that that would help. Plus, when you're starting it off with a Victorian alchemist, I think by the nature of Victorian and also alchemist, which is obviously not usually a current day term, it puts you in the mindset of, okay, now I kind of know the setting, as opposed to, again, halfway through the log line. So I think structurally you're right. It seems like it's out of place.
Yeah, it's also, I think it's just trying to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's this like information overload that I'm being pulled in a lot of different directions and I'm not quite sure what should be the focal point. I think a simplistic, stripped down version of this, maybe a little bit less flowery language, just give us a clear sense of the character stakes in the world, like as simply as possible. I just think that it's a little bit of everything, and I think that leads to a lot more questions than answers.
Right. And I was also curious when it says a way to reach the god she blames, is this a sort of a polytheistic society, or is it just the verbiage that's making it seem like there's multiple gods? You know, are we talking about the Greek gods, or are we talking, you know what I mean? As opposed to like in Victorian times, which, there is God in there. So that to me was a little bit confusing.
That's a great question. Just thinking about it a little bit more deeply, that ambiguity is problematic because there's a lot of ways to receive that. And I think like that, if that's a major focal point of the script, it's got to be clear on the page. It has to be, you know, again, this idea of half the audience shouldn't take it a different way. It's got to be 99% of people know immediately what you're trying to convey within that sentence.
Right. No, and I think that hits the nail on the head. If when people read your logline, 99% of the people need to know what this is all about. And I think you just hit the nail on the head right there. Now, they're talking about the alchemist putting an unwilling test subject through a painful metamorphosis at a masquerade ball. Is that enough of, especially for a feature, not a series, although, that I guess obviously is not enough to drive a series. You'd have to have more than that, because otherwise it's a single masquerade ball. But in a feature, do you get stakes there? Do you get...
It feels like a story, not a film.
Okay. And
what's the urgency there, right? Like,
right.
Why should I give a fuck, right? Like, I don't think that that's there at all.
And what about, are you curious about the test subject? And then, like, why? Like, it doesn't seem to be, we know that this alchemist is conducting tests on this individual, but we don't know anything about them. Does that matter to you, or you're so sort of out of it at that point, it doesn't really draw on you?
I think across the board, it's just, how do you get us to care about these characters? How do you get us to care about the stakes? How do you increase the stakes? You know, why does this masquerade ball matter? I just think that it's too many places, too specific. It's not enough of this overarching, what does the film look like in its entirety? Give us a snapshot of it. Get us to care about the character. Get us to care about the world. Get us to care about the stakes. Yeah. I don't think the writer does any of that with this one.
Right, right. And the title, Lunar Caustic? What do you think of the title?
No, it's almost like as bad as, what was the show? There was a show back in the day, 30 Rock. the rural juror.
Yeah, I remember that.
I mean, it's not quite the rural juror bad, but it's it made me think of that immediately. And I know I'm being way too critical. But that's the reality of it. You know, you have to make an impression with your title. The second you said the title, I was out. And then the log line, it's just the log line feels like the writer is just writing it for themselves, not for a particular audience in mind.
Gotcha. We didn't actually cover the title of the previous one. So, O Pariah, just the letter O, comma, Pariah, with an exclamation point, which is cool. O Pariah, is that a good title?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think there's just, it's a little too cute, a little too clever. It just doesn't feel like, there's no immediacy to it. I think some people may receive it one way, others differently. It's just being too cute. I don't like titles like that.
To me, it feels like a Coen Brothers.
Exactly.
Title.
Oh, Pariah, where art thou?
Right. That being said, I think if it was just Pariah, to me, that might fit.
That's better.
What did you say?
No, that's so much better.
Yeah. Okay, here's another one. The title is I Wanna Die With You. It's a horror feature, and the log line is, after the death of a founding member, an almost famous all-female rock band reunites at an island retreat to record a comeback album and must fight for survival when a monster from their past returns. I'll read it one more time. After the death of a founding member, an almost famous all-female rock band reunites at an island retreat to record a comeback album and must fight for survival when a monster from their past returns. Initial thoughts?
I would say that I would know immediately that that project wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. Super execution dependent, really depends on what the director brings to the table. The ceiling for a project like that is maybe a lower level film festival. It seems like a little bit too much of a mashup of genres, which could work. I think that there's got to be more in the log line. It feels a little bit longer than it needs to be, mm-hmm. But I don't think there's enough specificity. Just the idea that this generic monster, however that may manifest. I mean, I don't know. I don't know really what to expect going into reading a script like that. It just feels like a $500,000 string shoe budget, little indie that someone tries to put together. That's how I receive that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I agree with the monster from their past, meaning it seems a little ambiguous. Like, I want to know more about what this monster is. Are we talking like it's the dead founding member, the one who died, coming back as some sort of monster, or is it literally some monster from the island? Or to me that plays a huge role in it because that's your antagonist, and yeah, that sort of vague is, I don't know.
I mean, look, like the female rock band element is kind of interesting, yeah. But I just got to get a sense of how the monster is going to impact that. What does it look like? You know, like it's too generic, too broad. Greater specificity, increase the urgency. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the audience for this? Are they going to be scared? Like, why would someone want to watch this? For what reason? And I don't think that that's properly conveyed within the log line.
Right. And in my head, especially when you're talking almost famous female rock band, in my head, it views more of like a horror, I don't want to say horror comedy, but would have comedic elements. But I don't know if it does. And if that's not the intention, then I don't know. It doesn't come across as funny Evil Dead, nothing like that. But I mean, when you're talking about almost famous all-female rock band, to me that skews in that sort of quirky horror comedy stuff.
No, that's a great point. I don't know what the almost famous aspect is really adding. I mean, maybe there's just a cleaner way of phrasing it to show that they are not terribly established, or they're on the cusp of, or they almost reached fame. I don't know. It maybe sets up, it's too much of a setup of different expectations in terms of like very minimal emphasis on the horror elements. I think right. That's the biggest issue I have with it.
Right. But I do have to say, I agree, like you, the fact that it's an all-female rock band is intriguing and different, and so I can see that in my head, so I do like that. But now, as far as it being sort of an ensemble, do you want to know more? If this is an all-female rock band, do you want to know more about these band members, or is basically quote-unquote all-female rock band enough?
I mean, I think it's gonna, you have a good sense of perhaps what the characters are going to look like. Mm-hmm. I just think more importance needs to be placed on the monster and what that looks like and how the monster interacts with the band, what the backstory is. I mean, I know all that's tough to be articulated within the log line, but I care less about the band members themselves and more about, hey, how does this monster really factor into everything?
Right. And like you, I think the stakes, we don't get a good enough grasp of what the stakes are. And especially with something like this, I think they could definitely, it sounds like they may be able to play with it. Like, you know, they're about to record their album to take it to they're about to record their new album, but will they reach the top of the charts, or will the, you know, they could play with it, something like that. I mean, depending on if it's supposed to be sort of tongue in cheek and fun, like a horror comedy or not, but you know, with music or record lingo or something like that, just at the end to add sort of that tone to it and make it less just sort of laid out. And structurally, I think also starting with after the death of a founding member, maybe it could be an almost famous all-female rock band reunites after the death of a founding member. To me, at least we jump into it with who our main characters are. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on.
And the title, I Want to Die With You, I'm assuming that's just my guess. Like, that's probably their hit song or something like that, and it applies to the title. That's, I'm guessing what that is, but what do you think of the title, actually?
I think, to me, it just reinforces my initial reaction that it's a small, indie, sub $3 million production. Mm-hmm. It's not a commercially driven title, at least in my mind. I think a good horror title is like one or two words and maybe a double entendre. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, how does the title really convey in terms of what does this look like as a movie poster? I think it's okay in terms of a movie poster. Like, it does kind of give me a visual, but is it super catchy, super easy? Like, oh, hey, like I just saw, and then you say the name of this, and it's like, no, it's not like Get Out or It Follows or whatever. Like, you know, there's a lot more catchier titles than this one, but it may best reflect what the project actually is.
Right. Something like death metal or something. I don't know. That's maybe too hard of a title, but it implies horror and it also implies music, something like that, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a world where this works. I would say to the writer, continue to workshop it. There may be better suited titles for what this film actually is.
Gotcha. Okay, here's one, and it's called Development Hell, which is something I guess we all go through. Development Hell, and it's an animated TV comedy pilot. So it's an animation. And the logline is, six emotions have to go on a quest to save a neurotic screenwriter from overwhelming performance anxiety before they're wiped from existence. And I'll read it one more time. Six emotions have to go on a quest to save a neurotic screenwriter from overwhelming performance anxiety before they're wiped from existence. Initial thoughts?
I think diving into what that quest actually looks like would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a little bit more specificity, but it's quick, to the point. It's quirky. I like stories that deal with Hollywood and things like that, but the bar for things of that nature is super high. I just think a lot of writers love to write that kind of stuff. I don't think it's great if you're an up-and-coming writer and trying to break in, unless you're going to do the project yourself, meaning direct it. I mean, I know this is a TV animated thing, but just speaking more broadly, if you're going to tackle Hollywood or whatever, it's got to be small, indie, write it, direct it, finance it yourself. I just don't think that there's enough urgency. You want to do something like that, solidify your career first, and then you get to be Ryan Murphy and make Hollywood for Netflix.
One thing that I noticed, like I was trying to figure out the six emotions and the neurotic screenwriter, like where our focus is. And I don't know if that's just like the wording of it. It starts with six emotions have to go on a quest. So I'm assuming the screenwriter is not your main character. And if that's the case, then maybe it should change. If that's the true, it's really about the emotions, then that's totally fine. But to me, it definitely has that feel for Inside Out. Remember that Pixar film?
Right.
It definitely has that sort of feel, which is not bad. I love that film. But yeah, I'm trying to figure out more details. One, about the emotions. I don't know why I want to know that. I kind of do. But then again, you don't want to bog it down too much.
Oh, and that's great. Sorry to interrupt.
But no. Idea,
like, how do these emotions manifest on screen?
Yeah.
That's a little bit too ambiguous. I think it's a clever concept, but you're not really giving the reader enough clues to be able to really visualize it in their mind. Mm-hmm. And that like risks taking the reader out of it, because there could be something there. I'm almost wondering, like, is there a way to make a project like this, but why does it have to be a screenwriter? Like, it could be so much bigger than just focusing on Hollywood. Because this idea of like emotions going on a journey, what do they look like? That's neat. That's different. That's clever. But I think the screenwriter aspect of it took me immediately out.
Yeah, and I know that writing or films and TV about the industry, are sometimes difficult to, like you said, sometimes people in the industry just have a tendency to tune it out. They don't tend to be as mainstream, so to speak. I would also say that six emotions have to go on a quest. I kind of want to know, not in great detail, but I kind of want to know what this quest is.
Right.
And I'm not talking about leaving breadcrumbs so I can figure out what's going on, but like, is this quest an internal quest? Is it maybe they pop out of this neurotic screenwriter's head? I don't know. Like, it's, you know, they have to go on a real world quest or adventure, or, you know, I don't know. I would love to know more about that. And like, neurotic screenwriter, to me, neurotic is very broad. You know, like, people assume that most screenwriters or most writers in general are sort of neurotic, but like, I think that the verbiage there could be more powerful and to the point, whether, you know, like, you pick a specific behavioral thing, you know, that affects that screenwriter.
It's a cliche generalization. It reminds me of this time where a writer who had never been to LA, like, was like writing about Los Angeles and like focused too heavily on like traffic, gangs, and smog. And it's like, it's not 1992 LA. Like, I don't know, just be clever, think outside the box, give us a different point of view. Like, a neurotic screenwriter, oh really, you're really getting clever there. I don't know, it seems lazy.
Yeah, to me it could even be like, if you focused it, I think it makes it more sort of relatable and a little bit more unique. Like, if you said an obsessive compulsive or obsessive compulsive screenwriter, or, you know, some other sort of psychological issue that they have, but specificity to me would make it more interesting, like, no matter what it happens to be, so that you can kind of see it better, rather than, like you said, the stereotypical neurotic screenwriter.
An almost famous screenwriter? No, I'm kidding.
And then before they're wiped from existence, like, I get the existential threat there, and I get that's where the danger and sort of that challenge in the script is, what they have to, you know, fight against and rise up against. But you had mentioned earlier on, I don't know what that is, and I don't know why. And again, like, we don't need to know all the intricacies of that, but I would love to know more without getting too bogged down of why they're going to get wiped out. Like, why are your emotions going to get wiped out if they can't figure out this quest?
No, that's a good point. Yeah, I think it's give us a sense of how these characters really look on the screen, give us a deeper dive into the quest, and then maybe make the screenwriter either a totally different type of character or give the screenwriter a different character trait that goes beyond just being neurotic.
Right. How about narcoleptic?
No, yeah. I mean, that's different. That's quirky. It's outside the box.
Right. Also, do you see enough in this log line for it to give you confidence that this could be continued for multiple seasons?
It's funny. I know you said it was a series when we first started talking about it. It just feels like a better fit as a feature for whatever reason.
Right.
I know that's like low-hanging fruit in terms of notes, but I'd have a hard time getting a sense of why someone would have the urgency to keep watching something like this.
And for me, it seems like the quest to save the screenwriter, also saving themselves, because I guess if they don't, then they get wiped out. But the quest, once you finish that quest, it's over. It's like a feature. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
If it's an everlasting quest, then is it really a quest, or is it just sort of an overlying theme? Like, it's a consistent threat to them that they're, you know, like The Walking Dead, they're not in a quest to survive zombies. They just are surviving, you know, the zombie apocalypse. It's not like a quest. Like, if they get to the mountaintop in this hidden fortress and they're all happy in the end of the story, it's just sort of this consistent existential threat to their existence. And so to me, I don't know where it's going. And in the log line, and it could just be the word quest, because once you put in quest, there's a beginning of your destination, of your journey, excuse me, and your destination. That's it, right? That's your quest. You have a goal in mind and you are working to fulfill that goal, to finish that task, whatever it is, and then it's over. Maybe it's just changing of that. Maybe instead of just a quest, they're consistently working to help this neurotic screenwriter. I don't know.
No, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, I think that's a conversation that the writer really needs to have with themselves and kind of convey that there's staying power with this, that this is something that not just one season, you know, at least three seasons, you know, what does this look like and how do we get the broad strokes yet still manage to dive into enough specificity so that we really know what to expect as we dive into the project?
Right. Especially because, I mean, in theory, you could drag out a quest as long as you wanted to, but would an audience want to stick with you on this quest if it's an everlasting quest? It's like one of those series where there's sort of it's a love story where they're not able to get together and it drags on for seasons and seasons and audiences don't tend to respond well to that over a prolonged period of time. It's like, will they just get together already? But oftentimes when they do, it's the end of it. So it's hard to keep something like that going for a prolonged period of time, multiple seasons, when they never get to reach their destination. At some point, it tends to become unsatisfying. And if so, if they do reach it at the end of the season, that's great. But what happens after that? And from this logline with the quest, I don't personally get what comes next. And the title, Development Hell.
It's too inside baseball, cute, like, oh, it's when, like, say, like, a studio picks up a project and, like, we can't really crack it, and it's like, it's painful.
To me, I didn't think it was bad, but again, now that you're talking about it from a perspective of someone in the industry looking at it like that, I could see that, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's like my response to a title like that is like, what do you know about development hell? Like, I don't know. It's just, how does this say that you're trying to do anything other than generate interest from a manager or whatever, because you think like, oh, I'm going to write about Hollywood. People love to read about Hollywood that work in Hollywood. And it's like, yeah, sure. But like, is this a project? Is this a viable thing? Probably not. No.
To me, I took it more as like, it's one of those phrases that's thrown around in the industry and then they're using it. Like, what happens in Vegas? You just hear it becomes one of those things that becomes this catchphrase and you understand exactly what they're talking about. To me, they picked it because for people in the industry, they know exactly what that is. But I get what you're saying, that people in the industry looking at it may view it as sort of that.
Because I think the appeal is only the like wink towards someone like us, like we're in the industry, we know what it means. But beyond the scope of folks that work in Hollywood, does anyone really know what that means? If you're just a regular average person in New Jersey or somewhere else, like, I don't think so. And I think that that's problematic. I don't think that if I pitch the title to say, like, my mom, my brother, people I grew up with, that they'd have any sense of what to expect. And for that reason, I think it's a difficult sell.
Now, there were a few log lines that did not make it as far as I had thought that they would. Like, there's a few log lines. I skimmed some of them. I didn't read all. There were 425 submissions. There's no way that any human being could read that many. So we had a selection committee, you know, move the best 96 on. And you know, I skimmed them as they were selected. But there were a couple that I thought would make it pretty far that didn't go as far as I had thought. And I wanted to run a couple of those by you as well.
Yeah, sure.
To see what you thought. And I have to preface this one by saying I don't love the title, but I understand why they chose it. The title is called Wish List. And the log line is, when a technophobic Amazon delivery guy is ambushed in Mexico by a group of gangsters who mistake him for a drug mule, he must survive using only the packages inside his van. I'll read it one more time. When a technophobic Amazon delivery guy is ambushed in Mexico by a group of gangsters who mistake him for a drug mule, he must survive using only the packages inside his van.
I like that.
Yeah.
I can immediately picture that as a film.
Right.
I could give you a sense of who would play the Amazon driver. I get a sense of the world. I think it's a mixture of like action comedy. It's fun. I mean, it's definitely something that could land on Netflix or Amazon and pick up a viable audience.
Right. Now, technophobic Amazon delivery guy, the technophobic, I'm assuming, is to make it more difficult for the guy to be able to use whatever's in his van, I'm assuming. Does it need Amazon delivery guy, or do you think that's unnecessary in the log line? Like, you get it from delivery guy, right? Or do you think Amazon is the specificity of it helps?
I like the fact that by making it an Amazon delivery person, you have a wider range of what could be inside those packages.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense, like, if you just make it delivery guy, it could be just a little bit too generic and
Gotcha. Maybe
not that expectation. But like, if you think about Amazon, you could buy everything from like a barbecue smoker to a drill to weights. I mean, just like anything. I almost like spend time like on Amazon being like, oh, like what could I buy today? I don't know if I should have admitted that. I really haven't bought interesting. But there's a lot of crazy cool shit on Amazon. So I think there's a good justification for that level of specificity.
Right. And the title Wish List?
That seems like a kid Christmas movie.
Right. Oh, I was thinking like a Hallmark film or something.
Or like the spiritual sequel to Blank Check.
Right. Yeah. And I understand why they chose it, because that's obviously an Amazon term.
Too narrow of a focus. I like, as someone that uses Amazon every day, I didn't even connect those dots.
Oh, right. Yeah, I did. But for me, tonally, it like you said, it sounds like a kid's movie or a holiday film or something like that. Even though, and then that's huge, because like you had mentioned, and I noticed that some of the other judges, they definitely pick up on titles and title and log lines that I felt personally were not that they were bad, but like there were better log lines, but had worse titles versus log lines that, in my opinion, weren't quite as strong, but had really solid titles. The ones with the titles tended to go through, you know, or rate better for whatever reason. So obviously title is hugely important. So yeah, I mean, I would definitely look at that title personally.
So that log line didn't advance to the next round?
No, it didn't. It didn't go to the semifinals. And I thought it was a really, really solid log line. Again, the title I think needs work, because tonally to me it doesn't fit, but I thought the log line, the concept was great.
I wish we could like call up the manager or executive that passed on it and get them to weigh in right now, but I guess we can't do that right.
No. But yeah, so anyway, that one. And then there's another one that I really thought was solid. In my opinion, I liked it a lot. But it also did not go to the semifinals, I don't believe. Let me take a quick look. I don't think it did. No. And that I thought probably should have. And so let me read it to you. It's called Follow the Leader. And the logline goes, a down on her luck science fiction novelist becomes an accidental messiah when her latest book is mistakenly placed in the nonfiction section. And it's obviously it's a comedy feature. I'll read it again. A down on her luck science fiction novelist becomes an accidental messiah when her latest book is mistakenly placed in the nonfiction section. Initial thoughts?
I'd like to get a better sense of what the book is about.
Hmm, okay. That's a good
Like,
idea.
it sounds like a work in progress. Like,
Right.
I could get a sense of what that looks like as a film. I guess I'm not sure if it's like a kid's movie or if it's, where does this land? What does this look like? And I think that can become a little bit clearer. I just think that the writer's got to dive back in and just give us more context, give us more details. It's just a little bit too broad. It's a good setup, but I need more sense of, what we're actually talking about. You know,
Right.
what is the book and kind of where does it go from there?
No, and I think you nailed it when you said it's a great setup, assuming that there's a third act in the screenplay. But I would love to know, like, what in the log line specifically, what are the stakes? Like, we understand that she becomes an accidental messiah, and I think that's fantastic. That's a brilliant setup. I'm I can see it. I can see Amy Poehler or, Tina Fey or somebody in this, and I think it would be his a great trailer and hysterical. But what happens then? Like, I want to know a little bit more of what the stakes are. Like, she has to, it's not saying that it has to be this big thing, like she has to save the universe kind of thing. But what happens then? Like, where are you taking us? Because otherwise, to me, it could be a TV, like it could be a TV series, like it's sort of open-ended, but as a feature, I kind of want to know where you're going with it, to me.
Yeah, I agree. There's got to be more immediacy to it. And I think the writer left out important details that I think could give us a clearer sense from start to finish of what should be our expectations for a project of this nature.
Right. And what do you think of the title, Follow the Leader?
It doesn't seem to connect too well to, like, I mean, yeah, I don't know. It seems like a kid's kind of title. It doesn't work for me. I don't know. It just, I think there's an expectation with the log line where I'm hoping that it's going. That title, I think, kind of takes it in a different direction. So I
Right.
think once there's greater clarity within the log line, how do you make that better conveyed within the title? And
Right.
maybe it's the deeper dive into the log line will lead to making that particular title make more sense. So I think it's going to work both ways.
Yeah, I'm sort of neutral on the title. It doesn't strike me as a good or bad title. Again, it's one of those things like the other one, what was it called? I Want to Die With You, which I'm a theorizing that it's probably a song used in that for that female rock band. To me, maybe Follow the Leader, it maybe is the title of the book. It's my guess, something like that. That's what it sounds like to me. But yeah, I mean, I think you can think outside the box and maybe come up with something that's more striking, that kind of stands out a little bit. But yeah, I mean, that's just my opinion. Great. And now we've talked a lot about log lines, and I appreciate you taking the time to judge the log lines, and hopefully listeners out there who these aren't your log lines, but you can learn kind of from other people's log lines and sort of the feedback that they've been given and use it for your own log lines. I wanted to, I don't know, just find out what we always like to talk about what people are, since we're all in self-isolation, we like to find out what people are watching and reading and listening to. So what kind of stuff have you been watching on what's on your watch list? Not your wish list, your watch list.
It's funny. I feel like I've consumed all like the top tier stuff.
Well, what's
In
great
what's
that you've seen?
that?
What's great that you've seen recently?
I don't think I've watched anything lately that's really blown me away. I did just finish Ryan Murphy's Hollywood show on Netflix, mostly because our office or the building that our office is in, they used it as a location within the show. So that was kind of cool to see like my floor on TV. That was really the main reason why I watched it. I enjoyed it. I think it was fun. I think it was a good like revisionist history about post-World War II Hollywood. It was thought-provoking. Was it the best thing ever? No, I don't think so, but I think it's worth checking out. What else? I started watching Upload on Amazon, but I stopped. It's not for me. I think it's an interesting concept, but it's a little bit too light. It feels like a little bit networky or CWE, and that's just not the kind of stuff that I would normally gravitate towards. I've loved the Michael Jordan documentary on ESPN. I've watched all six episodes. I've recorded all of them. There's four more episodes to go. I believe it's called The Last Dance. It focuses on the 97-98 Bulls season, the sixth and final championship run. It's really well done. I think, like, yes, I love it because I'm a sports fan and a basketball fan, and I definitely like Michael Jordan. It's clever and interesting. It adds something new to the conversation. It's definitely a highlight for me. It's something that I like look forward to, gets me through the week. I think I've even like done like a deeper dive into other Jordan documentaries because of this. What is my guilty pleasure watch? I've been watching 90 Day Fiancé. It's just silly and mindless and stupid, but it's a good escape. I think it's like when I wake up in the morning, there's like maybe like a 2 to 5 minute window where I actually don't think about what's going on in the world. And I like almost forget for a second that there's a pandemic happening just outside the walls of my apartment building. I think the show like 90 Day Fiancé kind of provides that kind of escape. I can't say I recommend it to anyone. It's not like super well done or super interesting, but it's silly and it's fun. And I'm the kind of person that would normally spend 3 hours a night watching the news. I've reached a point where I just emotionally can't do that. It's too taxing. It's too sad. That's not to say that I'm ignoring what's happening. I'm definitely reading it all day on CNN or New York Times or whatever, but I've found that watching lighter things that make me laugh, things that make me just feel a little bit better are really what I need to prioritize. I think it was different maybe a month and a half ago. But at this point, it's just like I probably am putting in a good 10, 12 hours every day in terms of work. When it comes time to like relax at the end of the night watching TV, I just want to watch something that is a good escape.
I mean, we all have to have our guilty pleasures. I tend to watch documentary, those reality series on people living in Alaska. Don't think I'll ever live there, and I will never be one of those mountain many types, living off the land and killing what you eat and things. But I find it fascinating, the individuals and the things that they do. But I like my bed and warm showers too much to do that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, we all have those kind of things. Yeah, for me, it's watching some guy living out in the middle of nowhere hunting porcupines and things like that. It's really weird.
No, that's great. Look, I will say this. I've been rewatching some Alfred Hitchcock films. I most recently watched Strangers on a Train.
Great film.
So great. And then I think the week before that, I watched North by Northwest, and that really held up as well.
What are you reading? Are you reading anything for pleasure or no time?
Yeah, So I'm still reading so much for work. It's tough. I usually only maybe read a pleasure book during the summer and then a couple books during like the holiday break around Christmas time. But I did buy the book Relentless, How to Go from Good to Great to Unstoppable. It's written by this guy named Tim Grover. He was Michael Jordan's trainer and then
All right.
he Kobe Bryant's trainer. Mm-hmm. I haven't read a page of it. It's literally 2 feet away from me and is 2 feet away from me every day when I'm working. But I do want to read it. I would love to read it. I just don't have the time or the energy right now. Or I'm not prioritizing it, I guess is maybe the fairest way of putting it.
Yeah, we all have books on our shelves. It's like, you're meaning to read it. Like your watch list. There's 300 things in it and it just keeps growing and you try to watch what you can. But sometimes some things you just don't get to in a timely fashion.
Right. Now, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Have you read anything?
I'm reading a book right now. I can't remember the title offhand. It's over by my nightstand. It's on cyber warfare. I kind of find that fascinating. So I'm kind of diving into it's funny because I like things that are sort of these existential threats to us, but people don't know about. That's sort of so for example, a long time ago, years ago, and it wasn't very good because it was written a long, long time ago when I was just out of film school, but I written a pilot on the CDC, and it was an actual pilot on the CDC. And I had done a ton of research. I read maybe a dozen, 12, 14 books on the subject, seen multiple documentaries. So it's funny, and I've told this story on the podcast before, that back in late January, I kind of knew, because the warnings have been out there for decades, that this was going to happen. Now, nobody could predict when it would happen, because you can't predict when a virus or a disease is going to jump from animal to human, and it's a novel virus, meaning we have no sort of built-up immunity because it's new to us. But they knew it would happen at some point, and it would be catastrophic. And the warnings have been there for decades to prepare, but, you know, getting governments to actually do that, to put money into something for a threat that's invisible and many of them think is imaginary, like the asteroid coming and destroying the Earth kind of thing, you just don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
So not that cyber warfare is of the same sort of existential threat to humanity necessarily, but and you only hear about it in terms of like elections and things like that. But the fact that cyber warfare is a huge thing, that countries actively attack each other on a daily basis. And, whether it's, you know, the potential to shut down nuclear power plants or you know, totally screw up your power grid or, you know, any number of things that people just don't realize. You hear about it in random news stories, but you don't think about. Anyway, so I find that fascinating. I don't have, there's no pilot based on that or anything like that. I just find that in and of itself, this hidden world behind that we don't honestly see, but there's literally a war going on that we don't see, like us in China and us in Russia and you just don't see it, but it's active. It's an active war going on right now. But anyway, so that's the kind of stuff that I tend to read, this nonfiction on things like cyber warfare and virology and epidemiology and an end of the world pandemic. So, you know, happy stuff.
No, that's super interesting. I mean, yeah, like I need to carve out more time to really read things that don't have anything to do with, oh, could this be a movie? Could this be a TV show? Like, and I feel like I don't know how to turn that off.
Right.
I love to read. Like, obviously, being a good literary manager requires you to read. I never get bored of that. I mean, I get bored of reading bad script after bad script, but, you know, that's not the majority of my time. You know, most of my clients are writing things that get me excited, and that's fun. But, yeah, like, it would be really neat to be able to pick up a book and have no expectation of tying it into work. Just like it'd be nice to, like, watch a film and not critique it. I think that's even tough to turn off at times. You know, I just it almost forces me sometimes to rewatch things knowing exactly how I feel about it or felt about it the first time I watched it, especially if it's a comedy and like it has been a while. It's nice to just go into something, have like a very mindless approach and just be able to laugh and enjoy myself.
Right. Absolutely. No, I 100% agree. But it's tough. Like you said, it's tough to turn that off. So, well, that's it. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate all of your insights as always. And we'd love to have you on. We talked about it before for an AMA or a Q&A, or I don't even know what the proper term is. Is AMA only for Reddit? I don't know.
I don't know. I use that sometimes on Twitter.
Yeah.
I'll just do like hashtag AMA and then people just start asking me questions. And I don't know, maybe it is Reddit specific, but I think people have a general sense of what that means.
Yeah. Anyway, we'd love to, our Discord server, if you're not in our Discord server, please stop by. The link is on our website and on Twitter, I guess. But come check it out. We're consistently growing. We're over 300 members now. And ask questions. We're in there a lot. And we'd love to have Daniel in our Discord chat to do a Q&A. So I want to see if we can grab you for one of those at some point soon.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And that's it. So thank you again, Daniel. Thank you all for listening. And we will catch you on the flip side.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.